Investor Intelligence provides general information only. You should consider seeking independent advice to see how this information relates to your unique circumstances. Please refer to the terms and conditions available at investorintelligence.com.au for more.
Welcome to this week's episode of Investor Intelligence, your weekly podcast on all things investment, hosted by me, Jacob Kearns. Data and statistics are an incredibly powerful tool used in decision making. They're often used by investors to make investment decisions and also by the media to convey various messages. Today, we're going to analyze the role of data and statistics in making informed decisions and why it's important to not always have blind faith in them. With me today is Aaron Best, who has a career background in statistics and business analysis. Welcome back, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
So, Aaron, why is it important to not always have blind faith in data?
Well, stats are really important and stats are very powerful. And because stats are often represented as numbers and percentages, people will believe that they are correct 100% of the time. For most of us, like, our greatest experience working with numbers is probably maths when we're in primary school and high school. And in maths, you're taught that there is a right and a wrong answer to maths questions. There's not really any room for gray area, unlike subjects like English and even in science where you get to make hypotheses and there's room for interpretation in what you're seeing. With maths, you're taught you either get the answer right or you get the answer wrong. So we kind of conflate numbers with always having a right answer and a wrong answer. So we take that belief into our adult lives. So when people show us a percentage or a statistic, we believe that it must be correct and it must mean exactly what we were told it means. Statistics, however, are often the result of someone else's interpretation. And the danger of blind faith in statistics becomes that you don't know the motivation of the person who's done the research, who's come up with the statistics. And when I worked as a business analyst, for example, when I was working at the Victorian government, this is many years ago, I would often be asked by my manager to generate reports for senior management. And whenever she did ask me for these reports, my first question would be, what do you want them to show? And I remember the first time I asked her, what do you want the reports to say? She seemed really confused because she just asked me for a report. And so I said to her, I'm like, well, we were part of the transcription firm and we recorded every hearing. We transcribed most of them and we distributed most of those transcripts. I could run a report on how many hearings we recorded, but that did not reflect the number of transcripts that we were producing. I could run a report on the number of transcripts that we produced, but that didn't really reflect the number of pages of text that we were generating each day. Each transcript may have been distributed multiple times at different points over the course of many weeks or months. And we would also use overflow contractors when we produce transcripts to bolster the capacity of our internal staff. So if she needed a report that showed that we were busy, I might choose to use pages instead of number of transcripts. And if I wanted to show how much we were interacting with members of the court or external contractors or external agencies, then I might use the distribution data. So I would change what data I would use and what statistics I would come up with based on the story that I needed the data to tell, based on what she wanted to take through to senior management.
Right. So it's not necessarily that the data or statistics are wrong, but it's who's presenting the data, why, and what motives they might have, what story they're trying to tell, as you said.
Yeah, exactly. And people will cherry pick the data that they want to use so that they can come up with statistics that suit their narrative.
Okay, so what does this mean?
To give you a public example, again, when I was working for the government, we're always nervous about newspapers making freedom of information requests, because that means that they would get any information they wanted out of the government that wasn't classified. And I remember there was one newspaper one year that decided that they wanted to know browsing history for the Victorian Public Service.
Uh-oh.
So everything that the public servants were using the internet for. And the headline on the article came out with, "Public servants watch 25,000 hours of YouTube every day." And that sounds like a really big number. And the whole concept was kind of trying to make it about taxpayers should be upset that public servants are wasting taxpayer funds and time and that sort of thing. But then when you take that 25,000 hours and you break it down to the 350,000 public servants that are in Victoria, that's 4 minutes a day spent on YouTube.
Right.
And so 4 minutes a day is a whopping 1% of their workday was spent on YouTube. If the article's headline was Victorian public servants spend less than 1% of their time on YouTube, I don't think anyone would have a problem with that. I know in other aspects of anyone's job, they probably will refer to YouTube for things to do with work. Like, you may not necessarily be watching your favorite YouTubers or whatever it is when you go on YouTube. You may be looking at information to do your job. So the stat on its own of 25,000 hours spent on YouTube every day doesn't accurately reflect what is most likely happening in the world.
Yeah, it's very misleading.
It is. And time is one of my favorite metrics to use when you want to massage data. Minutes, hours, days, months, they're not proportionate to each other. And what I mean by that is we know that a kilometer is 1,000 meters and a meter is 100 centimeters and a centimeter is 10 millimeters. It's really easy to calculate in your head because you just have to add a zero onto the end to convert them. But when you're talking about months and years, you've got 12 months in a year, and then you've got approximately 30 days in a month, and then you've got 24 hours in a day, and then you've got 60 minutes in an hour. And so the difference between, say, hours per day and minutes per day can make a big difference when you are talking about these sorts of stats.
So you can almost change the effect of how something sounds by giving a different unit of measurement. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And it comes down to the human perception. You want an impressive number when you are throwing data at people. So if your number isn't impressive, then you might go around and change it. As I said, 1% of someone's workday is spent on YouTube isn't as impressive as saying 25,000 hours are spent per day across the entire public sector.
And similar to pricing psychology too, right? If you say something is $12,000 a year, that might sound like a lot of money, but if you break it down to $1,000 a month or $33 a day, doesn't sound like as much as the original $12,000 a year. So you can change the perception of how something sounds.
Yeah, we at the Property Mentors, we have that conversation with people a lot where they're talking about their property management. And some property managers will charge 5% of your rental income as a management fee. Other property managers will charge you more. In some states, it's common to get charged like 11 or 12%. And the difference between 11% and 5% sounds like a lot when you're working with numbers as small as 5 and 11, but actually when you take into consideration exactly how much you are getting in rent, the difference can often be $30 a week that you're basing your decision on whether or not to choose someone to look after a $500,000 property. So the difference between $30 a week and $500,000, it's a really interesting concept that people get hung up on 1% on their management fee. Recently, we've seen a lot of talk about rental increases and the rental crisis happening in Australia at the moment. I believe it was a Greens politician came out and made the claim that rents are going up at their fastest rate in 35 years, which technically is true, but it doesn't paint the whole story because it's only the fastest rate in 35 years if you're measuring quarterly. If you measure annually, then that drops down to 15 years. And the quarterly rate is also only slightly higher than what it was in December 2008, so 15 years ago. It was 2.3% for the quarter to December 2008. It was 2.5% to the quarter March 2023. The sentence that rents are going up at their fastest rate in 35 years kind of paints the picture that rents have been steadily increasing constantly for 35 years and we're now hitting this peak moment, whereas the actual statistics show that they always change and we will have some faster points and we'll have some slower points. And yes, when you measure quarterly, the rents are increasing by their fastest rate in 35 years. However, if you look at the 35 years before that, like prior to 1988, rents were increasing a significant amount every quarter, much more than they have in the last 20 years. So it's really interesting to take that one sentence and not show the data that supports it, because when you look at the data, it's not quite as scary as fastest rate in 35 years makes it seem.
Yeah. So again, cherry picking to base that on a narrative that you're trying to say.
Yeah, exactly. And it's often something that you see with politicians. I know when I do see a politician particularly make a claim, any claim that involves statistics, my first impulse is to Google it. I want to know what the stat is and where the stat came from, because a slight change in wording can make a huge difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. A really good example of that is talking about headlines in the media with property, how they sort of talk about median house pricing, and they take the median as opposed to the average because they can paint a picture of what they're trying to say.
Realistically, so the statistical sort of standard of when you should use average versus when you should use median is based on whether you have a set of data that is skewed. So if your data is a perfect bell curve, then you can use average and it's generally a good representation of the data set. But if you do have a skewed set of data, then the median is more likely to represent the truth, which is why we use median house prices instead of average house prices. Because as an example, if you've got a median house price of $500,000, then the prices that are less than $500,000 are only between zero and $500,000. There's a limit of what could be less than that. But what could be greater than that could be 1 million, could be 1.5, could be 2, could be 3, could be 4 million. So because the upper end of that scale could be anywhere, if you started taking averages, a $5 million property would offset 10 $500,000 properties.
Right.
Whereas if you look at the median price, it takes the halfway point in the data. So yeah. If you're using 100 houses as the data set, then the median house price is the 50th house price.
Mm.
When we're talking about median house price, it represents how many properties less than that value are in the market. It doesn't represent the average price of property. It just represents properties less than that value is equal to the number of properties that are more than that value. It doesn't actually reflect necessarily exactly what pricing is likely to do. And you're right, there are lots of different factors that can be taken into account when you're talking about property house prices. And a slight drop in median house price doesn't necessarily mean that houses are worth less. It just means that there are more houses that are a lower value entering the market, because the median house price is also measured by sales, not by every property.
Right. And that example is often used to paint the picture of a downturn in the market. Median house prices are going down.
So when you are talking about pricing dropping and things like that, you also do have to look at, are they generalizing on median house prices and are they painting every sale with the same brush, or are they looking at a specific subset of certain properties? I've heard discussed on the podcast before the difference that property types and suburbs can make. Is the value of apartments increasing in a certain suburb while the value of houses is decreasing? And at the moment, the Australian property market is rebounding quite strongly, and we're seeing that Melbourne prices are increasing, but that doesn't mean that you should expect every single property to show an increase in value.
Mm. So a lot of investors are looking at data and statistics when making investment decisions. What should they be doing or thinking about to make sure they've got the whole picture?
Well, you don't necessarily have to be skeptical of information that you see. If it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Feel free to be skeptical of that. But for the most part, being critical of data is really important. So who gave you a stat? Do they have a vested interest in you believing that statistic? Particularly when going back to what I was saying before, in the world of politics, statistics will be thrown around by politicians mostly to support their own views, and they won't offer you objective information. They won't go, oh, well, on the opposite side of the coin, it's worth also being aware of this. They'll literally just tell you the piece of information that is most important to get their message across and get you on side with them. So taking that information and looking into it yourself can be really helpful. You don't have to be a statistician. You don't have to be a business analyst to be able to look into those things. A lot of news agencies will publish their own fact checks. So I know that the ABC is really good at doing fact checking on what politicians are saying. And what fact checks usually involve are the news outlets going to universities and talking to people who are impartial and asking them to analyze, well, what was the statistic? Is the statistic a valid statistic? Or should people be considering it in conjunction with other pieces of information? Understanding that motivation can be really important. I remember during the COVID pandemic, a lot of people were using stats to justify certain things and justify the restrictions. And on the opposite side of the coin, people were using stats to say that vaccinations weren't important and that we should be allowed out. So you had both pro-vax and you had anti-vaxxers all throwing statistics out there to try and convince people of their opinions. And as a society, I remember every day we were waiting for the health department to release their statistics on their Twitter. And then you'd see every news outlet would publish their own article about what those statistics mean. One other thing that I find is really important for people to get their full picture is to think about not just looking at things that will support their own biases. I remember having an argument with someone because I was reading a newspaper that they thought was too right-wing, and they said that I should be focusing only on reading left-wing newspapers and things like that. But limiting yourself to only news sources that will support your own thoughts mean that you'll just see statistics and you'll just see news that supports your own thoughts and feelings. I will on occasion read other news articles and other mastheads to look at what the other side of the argument is saying and determine where there is that manipulation of statistics to make me believe one thing or me believe something else. And the last thing would be that it's really important to understand the difference between qualitative and quantitative data. Not just looking at a statistic, because statistics are often quantitative data. They're usually numbers, say 50% of people believe this or 50% of people do that. And they discount human behavior as the reason for why that statistic actually exists. For an example, you might see a statistic that high-income earners are more likely to have private health insurance. And this stat alone may make you think that that's purely because they have more money. But it doesn't really take into consideration that if a high-income earner doesn't have private health insurance, the government will tax them the Medicare levy surcharge. And you may also find that people who are high income earners are more likely to be a little bit older. And again, if you're over 31, the government penalizes you for not having private health cover. Mm. So the reason that more high income earners have private health cover may not be because they have more money available to spend on private health cover. It may be because they're of a certain age or because they don't want to receive that higher tax.
Right. So it's looking at a statistic, asking yourself why that might be, and looking at arguments on both sides as to what that might be saying to you.
Yeah, exactly. Just taking a statistic on face value and not thinking about particularly the human behaviors that go into forming that statistic can mean that you are manipulated into believing a narrative that isn't actually the case. So it's really important to not just go, okay, well, I've heard this statistic and I was fed this one reason as to why that statistic is. So I should believe that that's the case.
Mm. And something might be true, but it's going that extra layer deeper and understanding why or what are the nuances around that. Yeah, that's definitely interesting points. I'll definitely be thinking about how I interpret statistics and not just looking at them at face value. I got a lot out of this episode and I hope our listeners did too. Thanks for your time, mate.
Thanks for having me.
If you found this episode or any of our episodes helpful, please make sure to share and leave a rating to help us reach more people on their investing journeys. And of course, subscribe to be notified when new episodes drop. Make sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at Investor Intelligence Podcast. You can find links to our other socials in the show notes, including a link to the Property Mentors weekly blog. If you're ready to get your property portfolio in shape for financial freedom, check out Luke's latest book, Property Fit. You can get yourself a copy at www.propertyfitbook.com.au.